The Rufus Project would like to advise the following podcast contains spoilers for Jurassic Park 3 from 2001. If you do not wish to have this movie spoiled, we suggest you watch it before listening to the following podcast. We decided to check out the sequel ignored by the latest blockbuster sequel to Jurassic Park. Christian and I watched Jurassic Park 3. Was it redeemable? You can find out after the theme.
Boy? Oh boy.
Is it too good to be bad? So bad it's good. What's this movie? Do you think we should've got that? I love dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy? Oh boy.
Hello and welcome to the Rufus Project Redeeming Features cast. This time looking at 2001's Jurassic Park 3. I'm your host, Trevor Holland, and I am joined by my good friend and co-host,
Christian Fletcher. Thanks for having me again, Trevor. Always interesting to be talking about a new redeeming feature and whether a film can be redeemed or not.
Absolutely. And yeah, like I said, I find this one fascinating because it kind of got completely written out of the Jurassic Park canon with the recent blockbuster Jurassic World. I'm just wondering if, I really want to find out, is that an injustice or is that perfectly justified? I guess that's what we're here to find out.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that we've got you to be able to at the helm with that sort of stuff, Trevor, because I'm going in very, very naive, I suppose is the word, having only seen Jurassic Park 1 and Jurassic World and, of course, the third one. So not having seen the second movie, I'm feeling like, yeah, I'm a bit up in the air too, so I'm glad that we've got someone who's a bit more familiar with the series. And yeah, to be honest, at first, though, I was thinking, its inclusion in the redeeming features, is it worthy? But from the sounds of it, it seems to be quite divided amongst both camps on whether it's, whether it's something that doesn't quite fit in with the series or whether it is just a bad movie on its own. I'm not sure. So I'll be interested to hear the reviews.
Absolutely. So, before we get to that, we'll start with a bit of turkey trivia, as we like, and talk a bit of turkey about this potential turkey. It was put together with a budget of about $93 million, and it ended up grossing over $368.5 million worldwide. So I'm guessing it didn't do too badly. I'm suspecting a lot of that may have been riding on the success of the previous movies.
Oh, definitely. Like, to see a huge profit in that respect, Trevor, that is, I was stunned, actually. I was surprised to see that it even had box office of that amount. But as you said, with that built-in sort of franchise, and I think, not skipping too far ahead, I think that's what might have meant they were quite lax in other departments of making this film, because they kind of had the series to fall back on. It's almost like, hey, we'll just tag the Jurassic Park name on it and all will be okay. So I think there was always it was always a given that it was going to make quite a lot of money. I just didn't think it would be that much.
Yeah, well, I think it was I think number two was a much more suspenseful affair. I've got to admit, it's been a long time since I've seen number two. I can actually not recall all that much about it. So I think they were kind of wanted a bit of a different flavour and bring a bit of the action back for number three. But again, we can also get into whether or not that was successful or not as we discuss this further.
And I noticed it being filmed, for example, in Hawaii as well, was one of the main places. Originally, it was going to be filmed in New Zealand, apparently, because I actually thought a lot of it seemed very familiar, like it could have been somewhere like New Zealand, but no, eventually most of it was filmed in Hawaii. So I'm surprised that still with a budget of $93 million and all this location shooting, that they were able to bring it down. Yeah, that is a pretty small budget to have, considering we're comparing to some turkeys that we've talked about in the past that have been well over that and managed to achieve not as much on screen. So they've got to be, we've got to give them credit for that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think maybe like some of the stuff in there may have been pre-existing equipment. If we move on to a bit of trivia now. According to an interview with William H. Macy, who is in this movie, he said that one of the newer animatronic dinosaurs, the Spinosaurus, had like a 1,000 horsepower motor
and it could turn its head at twice the force of gravity, and like the tip of its nose would move at a speed of more than 100 miles per hour. So I'm thinking that the terrified responses by the actors when this particular dinosaur turned up may have been genuine.
You wouldn't want some guy behind the control desk that can't keep it under control, because yeah, you might actually be having some real dinosaur attacks on set. So yeah, I suppose hey, that would have helped them give it a bit more of a realism for them anyway, rather than acting against say screen or something. So, yeah. But my big question while I was watching this is, you know, probably just touching on what you said about with the reviews and things, but I'd be interested to see why this essentially killed the franchise for over a decade, because, you know, up until then you had Jurassic Park 1 and then the second one was 1997, so they were technically always 4 years between. So when you see that this one came out in 2001 and the next one was 2014, it was quite a big gap. So I was really quite interested to know, yeah, why had this killed the franchise so much? But I think for anyone that sees it, you can kind of, I don't know, there are very telling signs.
Yeah, I'm wondering if maybe it was the lack of Jeff Goldblum, because, I mean, he featured quite prominently in the first two movies, and but apparently he was not invited back to reprise his role in number three. Do you think maybe that had an impact?
Yeah, I think so, and I think that would have been the biggest mistake they made. And it was like, as I said, not having seen the second one, I believe Sam Neill and Laura Dern are in the second one, so it was almost like this third one felt like, oh, okay, we can't go down the path of number two. Let's go back to the people we used in the first one. And I almost felt that Sam Neill and Laura Dern were just kind of, I don't know, they felt like they had to bring them back. They were barely even, well, more Laura Dern, were barely in it, but I just sort of felt they were trying everything they could to replicate possibly the success of the first one and possibly two as well. So it made it come across very much like just a walk in the park sequel, you know, just like one of those Friday the 13th movies. You know, I love those movies, but, you know, after you've seen 7, 8, 9 and all that sort of thing, they all sort of become the same. And it was becoming, it had the feeling of that to me, you know, that was a big thing that was coming through.
Okay, well, before we get too deeply, I suppose, into our thoughts, it's always so hard to resist, isn't it?
I know. I even tried to rate it in that time and it didn't work.
Yeah. Let's have a little look at what somebody else thought. So I've dug up a review on Jurassic Park, and as per the redeeming features, we start at the bottom end of the scale and try to end on a high where we can. So this review basically is titled "The Film That Destroyed the Jurassic Park Series." This film was so glaringly bad, it only shows that Universal really does not care for the fans of this once promising series. It's a juvenile follow-up that really makes its predecessors look really bad. Sorry, a bit of a typo was in there. And that's just a great feat considering the fact that the first two had a little thing called class. Steven Spielberg surrenders the directional control to Joe Johnson, who proves, without a doubt, how Spielberg is the master of filmmaking by his extremely lack of talent. There is no direction to be found here, and the confused look on the actors involved is a clear indication of this. Sam Neill and William H. Macy are two gifted actors who literally destroy their reputation with performances that clearly contradict their talents, and the rest of the actors involved are just as bad. There is literally no sense of plot to go by, and there is no climax. The dinosaur effects are not even up to standard, and that's a sad case because it came from the same team that did the first two movies. Those who think that this is an improvement of the last one are either mentally challenged or being paid. Do yourself a favour and pretend that this movie does not have anything to do with Jurassic Park. Rent Jurassic Park and The Lost World instead. 1 star.
I can definitely see some of the things that they said. A bit harsh in some respects, but I did feel that the feeling that, you know, they almost were going through the motions with it. They weren't creating anything new and exciting to add to the franchise. Like, it was, as I said, yeah, going through the motions, you know, sums it up perfectly, I think. And, you know, I did read one review saying it was pretty much nothing more than a theme park ride for kids. And, you know, pretty much at the end of it, it pretty much is, I suppose. But then it all comes down to what's defined as entertainment and what's defined as, you know, something that's advancing a plot of a book or something like that. So, yeah, there's a lot of things in that review that I understood, but it did feel very much why does this exist?
Sure thing. I mean, it is rated, I don't know if you've covered this before, but it is rated 5.9 on IMDb. So I guess that's a bit of an indication that has its detractors, but it must also have fans. So I think it's another one of those divided opinion movies, to tell you the truth, even with some of the people that I have spoken to. I mean, most people have said that, well, they kind of enjoyed it, but I can't say there have been too many out there that have really come to its defence.
And, like, I've noticed that, you know, a lot of things, you know, like, one thing that you mentioned earlier is the fact that it has, you know, virtually no, like, I have seen Jurassic World, but I can't even remember, there is literally no reference to number three in Jurassic World, yeah. So that's probably the, it was almost like they've gone, oh gosh, we want to get as far away from that as possible and bring the series back to what it used to be. But one thing that really stood out to me that I really liked about number three was the fact that it kind of did what number four did and started bringing in the whole concept of profiteering from these dinosaurs. And yeah, okay, I know that, you know, they touched on that in the first two being, you know, the theme park essentially. But, you know, the whole fact that they've got, you know, all these business propositions and the perfect thing, the opening shot or the, you know, the opening scene when they're on that, the dinosaur parachute, S-O-A-R parachute, and, you know, you get the chance to parachute right next to the island and even go over the top of the island and stuff like that. And that was sort of that whole thing that they brought in a lot with number four, which is the whole product tie-ins and how pretty much business and economics can pretty much drive these, you know, people to do pretty bad things, you know. And, yeah, so I felt that was something that was very similar to number four.
Yeah, but, I mean, I suppose to touch on what might be a bit of a theme in my comments as we discuss this. I mean, that opening paragliding sequence, I mean, I don't think it was entirely officially endorsed as a tourist attraction. It was, I think, kind of a bit of a side project by some not-so-professional people, but really, was there any doubt as to where that sequence was heading?
Oh, I know. It even felt really tackily shot, it was cheesy. It sort of lacked the wonderment of previous sort of installments of the film. Like, you had this great sort of cinematography, this great sort of scenery, but it just kind of seemed quite daggy, this father and son parachuting over the, it wasn't, you know, it didn't reach, say, the previous two films, you know, a wow factor.
Yeah, and where did the mist come from? I mean, they were just going along, it's a perfectly sunny day. There is not a cloud in the sky. You know, it's an absolutely perfect tropical paradise day. The boat that's towing this parachute, so this kid and it wasn't actually his dad. It was, I don't know if his stepdad or someone linked to the family in some way, are paragliding behind this boat.
Okay, and then, one thing confusing.
Sorry?
Oh, that was one thing that was confusing to me the whole way through. I'm like, but he's not your dad. He is. So thank you for clearing that up.
No, William H. Macy was the kid's father.
Yeah. But yeah, the other guy too. Yeah, I did get confused about how he fitted in with it. So the guy disappeared. So I'm glad worked that out. But yeah, the swell of mist that seemed to just engulf the boat just seemed to come from nowhere. But hey, it made for, you know, good filmmaking, possibly. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it was the first of convenient plot-related devices that really have no realistic bearing on anything else rather than to set up what's going to happen. And I've got to admit, I think the first 10, 15, maybe even 20 minutes of this movie, it was all setting up and, like, all the stuff just kept happening. Oh, look, I've 3D printed the voice box of a raptor. Gee, that's not going to come in handy later. William H. Macy goes, I've got a proposition for you, Sam Neill, and has the big mustache and the glasses. And they go, oh, no, he's not shady at all. That's surely not going to go anywhere. really, like I said, even like Sam Neill's sidekick, the other paleontologist whose name I have now completely forgotten.
As in the character's name.
Yeah, Billy Brennan.
Yeah, that's
played
it.
By Alessandro Nivola. You know, he was, it was a big thing made of his lucky backpack and how his strap had saved him while he was, like, base jumping And it's like, okay, here's an extreme sport night with a lucky backpack. That's not going to come into the plot at all, is it? There was just
when he jumps off a cliff later, and we think he's all dead, or is he not? Oh yeah, it just seemed like all those sort of things, like you were saying, like the backpack and the raptor voice boxing. It was just setting they were just such obvious setups. I know, like a lot of films, you can see these sort of setups coming a mile away, but this just may as well have had neon lights around it going, guys, we're going to reference this later. That's all that I felt a lot through it, the whole thing. And what I love about that raptor voice box thing is when he's testing it originally to show Sam Neill, it sounds kind of, you know, whatever. But then when they end up using it in front of the raptors, it's got a totally different sound, but seems so much more like what it's supposed to. I thought that was interesting.
Well, Sam Neill, he is the raptor expert, so yes, if anyone definitely can use that raptor voice box properly, it's got to be Sam Neill.
Boy, but oh god, one bit I can't remember the what part of the film it is, but it is amongst my notes, and it did stand out as a funny bit. But the part where he actually dreams that a dinosaur is trying to wake him up, is that exactly what I can't remember if that's what happened? But that one shot made me go, "What the hell?" That was just one thing that stood out as really just. Yeah, they could have easily done without. He's got dinosaurs on the brain. He's even dreaming about them.
Yeah, I mean, that was probably the one scene I really knew from this movie. I mean, I had never actually seen this movie until watching it for this podcast, but I had seen so many references to there's a raptor on a plane going, Alan! That seeing it in context, I've actually found that kind of satisfying, because that one scene had me wondering for so long, how does that actually work into the movie? And now we know he's just absolutely fascinated and obsessed with raptors and proving his theory about raptors.
And anything they can do to state the obvious, I suppose, that he's even more obsessed, you know. But there was something like you mentioned in your other review before about, you know, like whilst the dinosaurs still look fine, there was something about it that they just felt a little bit off to me, and I don't know whether it was, like, I have read that they went back and retouched up some of the characters, like since new discoveries have been made in paleontology, they actually went back and changed, you know, based on new discoveries they'd made. But I don't know, some of the dinosaurs just felt a bit not fake to me. There's just something, they didn't feel like the other movies, let's just say. So I don't know if that was a quality control issue, I'm not sure, or not having Steven Spielberg at the helm, I think.
I think potentially by the time they got to number three, I mean, the first Jurassic Park, when it came out, of course, just wowed everyone with these effects, and a lot of them were practical effects. And like models and animatronic models, inserted into the movie. By the time they got to number three, I don't know, it's just kind of going, I think some of that magic had been lost by then, and even probably with the people making the movie, with regards to, I suppose, just utilizing these tools. It certainly, in the dinosaur department, it certainly does seem to have less polish. But then you've got to wonder if maybe, because I know that when I think about the first Jurassic Park, even rewatching the first Jurassic Park movie, there is such a massive, like, almost wave of nostalgia. And there's still this tinge of what I felt when I first saw that movie and was amazed by these dinosaurs on screen. That in itself is such a hard thing for any movie coming after it to live up to, and that probably was a big impact here for number three.
And it's like it's sort of almost sort of lost that wow factor because we were so used to it. And as you said, the first one, and I've even heard on Blu-ray, the first one even stands up amazingly. And you'll notice even in the third one, I thought this was interesting, they had to have the typical scene where they come, I think they were in the boat, and it comes around the corner, and it's the theme music and the shot of the field and all the dinosaurs. It was like they ripped that, they wanted to capture that exact same feel as when they first see the park in the first movie, and it just felt like they were really just trying to rip that off and capture that feel. But it's like what you were saying, it's quite hard to replicate, you know, something that you saw in that first movie. And I know that feeling that you felt, because I remember thinking that exact same thing, and I was pretty young at the time, and it was quite scary. So I think by 2001, which, yeah, we would have been quite conditioned to it, so it's almost like it needed to have that 13-year break for Jurassic World to come back with something even more wow for us, I think.
Give us a fresh look. And I can categorically say that Jurassic Park does stand up on Blu-ray. Because, yeah, I kind of own it. But that's getting beside the point.
Yeah. But I love one bit how this kid's met it. You know, we lose the, back to number three, we lose the kid, they lost the kid for about 8 weeks in the park or in the wilderness. And I love that within 30 minutes of having seen his parents, he gets taken by a pterodactyl. I thought I was sitting with someone and we had a laugh about that bit. So it was almost like Tia Leone and William H. Macy were just like so accident prone. It just seemed to follow them throughout the whole movie. But hey, it made things a bit more, made a few more obstacles for them. Because like I said earlier with that review, it does feel like a theme park for rides. It's like pretty much one set piece or one sort of fight with the dinosaurs and then a bit of a break and some kind of, I don't know, bad dialogue or not much dialogue and then into the next scene. So that's pretty much what the whole feeling of the film was to me.
Yeah, it was just so much, set piece to set piece and just so much convenient location on the way. Like when they're trying to get from, because obviously they fly to the island, the plane crashes, they've got to try to get to the coast. They're walking through this super thick jungle on this massive island, and the path takes them directly to the parachute from the first from the paragliding scene at the start of the movie. You know, they could have just been 10 meters on either side in this jungle and they never would have seen it. But there it is, right there, exactly in the direction they're walking.
So it's like they really didn't want to have to think too much about it, I think, the script writers. And it's not exactly good filmmaking. It's more, they were going through the motions so much, and I think it came through in so much of the script writing. They just thought, okay, we've got this franchise that's still going so well, we can pretty much just make a movie that's just dinosaur attack after dinosaur attack. That's all they need to see. And that's pretty much where it ended. And any sort of feeling of, well, it wasn't even sort of plot development, or you sort of wanted the series to be sort of developed in some way or something new to take on, but it just never seemed to get there.
Oh, but do remember, I mean, they're, because obviously raptors are a big part of this. I mean, they've got their big bad dinosaur, but this time it's a Spinosaurus instead of a T-Rex. The T-Rex does turn up, but actually gets killed by the Spinosaurus. But you go, oh, but the T-Rex is part of Jurassic. Oh,
I know, you felt a bit sad.
But then, you know, of course, they're being stalked by raptors. But there is a plot development, because we find out why the raptors are stalking them. Not that we need to, because within 5 seconds of them finding a raptor nest full of eggs and they're walking away and Billy's looking a little bit shifty and you just go, I wonder what's in Billy's lucky backpack.
And then you've got the part where Tia Leone is giving it back to it and you almost think she's going to start having this moment with this mother dinosaur. It just kind of was, I didn't know where it was going. But hey, she had to give the eggs back. But yeah, I'm like going, what, the next thing you're going to sit down and have a cup of coffee and talk about your husbands or something? I don't know.
Yeah, or just go, you know, just turn around and just go, Amanda! Just like the Alan Dream from the front of the side of the movie.
Yeah.
Thanks, Amanda! But no, it responds to Sam Neill going, with the replica raptor voice box.
The voice box that sounds so much bigger and bolder than it did before. But it did feel like they were throwing everything in the kitchen sink and hoping, what is it, throwing everything to the wall and hoping it sticks. And I think that's what a lot of this film was about to me.
I mean, I did find some parts of it, like within that. I mean, I've got to admit, I did get swept up in the action a few times, but again, even though it was pretty obvious when one of the survivors of the plane crash is kind of just like lying in a field and they don't know if he's alive or dead. And, you know, it's pretty obvious that he's bait. And sure enough, we find out that the raptors had left bait for the humans. And I actually thought that was something which added a bit more to the movie. It kind of took it beyond just the step by step by step and actually like threw in a brief bit of like additional tension that it really did need.
Definitely, yeah. And, you know, it sounds like, you know, not knowing sort of the history about the script, but it sounds like it went, must have gone through a lot of script writing, script rewrites or something, or it must have been that, they must have been trying to get it off the ground for a while, because it feels like it, a lot of people had their hands in it, and they never quite got it to where they wanted it to be or where it should have been, so.
Well, actually, a bit of trivia that I didn't read out before, but relates to that, is the fact that apparently they started filming Jurassic Park 3 before they'd finished writing Jurassic Park. So that may explain.
That's usually a warning, usually a warning sign in a film. But yeah, no, I think yeah, that's usually a warning sign. So I think yeah, that would have been a lot to do with it. So I think they were just really eager to cash in on the franchise and not really thinking too much about, I don't know, making a good film or making you know. And it's not saying it's a bad film, but you know what I mean. They're not making a cinematic masterpiece.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you look at the characters themselves. I mean, look, I'm a big fan of William H. Macy. Anytime he turns up, I immediately feel better about a movie because I think he's a very underrated actor, but he has appeared in some very dodgy things.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, you have himself, you have Tia Leone playing his wife, and you've got, they're accompanied by these apparent mercenaries, and they all seem pretty useless. And then the kid turns up who has disguised himself, like built himself like a grass suit, and has collected Spinosaurus Wii because it keeps the other dinosaurs away, and has been surviving for like 8 weeks on what appeared to be leftover vending machine snacks almost. When Sam Neill turns up, he's sort of like saying, oh, you know, this is pretty much the last of it. And, like, you know, this kid is pretty much the most resourceful character in the entire movie, when really you know that in any realistic circumstances, not that it's realistic, he would have been, like, dinosaur chow within 2 days.
I think he would have been a bit more beaten up and, I don't know, a bit more bruised and disheveled when they find him. It's almost like he's just kind of like, hey, welcome to my version of Swiss Family Robinson. He's all set, ready to go. But then you look at the characters that Tia Leone and William H. Macy are playing, though. They wouldn't be able to survive 8 weeks anywhere. You know, they seem to be that kind of character. So you had it hard to believe that that son came from the same parents. But then I also found it really hard to believe that they were husband and wife. It was always, I don't know if it was just weird, I don't know if it was the pairing of the characters or the pairing of the actors, but I found that really hard to believe, them being husband and wife.
Well, they were separated, to be fair.
Oh, yes.
Basically, got back together to find their son on this island full of gigantic stomping.
And that's, I think, where the confusion came in about the guy parachuting at the start. I thought that may have been the new partner she'd had, but I'm like, God, she didn't take long to get him. So, yeah, it mustn't fit in that respect. So.
Yeah. Okay, another bit I found quite amusing, again, involving, you know, the little family unit within the movie, is that, like, all the way, you know, they're running around and they're shouting for the kid and they're shouting at the kid's name, and Sam Neill's going, that's really a bad idea, we shouldn't make so much noise. And then when they get back together, it's just like, you know, I probably should look up the kid's name, that might be helpful.
That's all right.
Eric, that was it, Eric the kid, you know. Eric! Dad! And they're like yelling their lungs out.
Yeah.
And surprisingly, when they finally find each other, and again, like, nothing had actually separated them apart from distance, but yet when they find each other, they're on opposite sides of a very large, very sturdy fence. Which, again, okay, hang on, how did they get that fence between them?
Yeah.
You know, this fence is obviously a perimeter fence, so there's no way that they should have inadvertently crossed over this fence at some point in the past.
Yeah, oh, it's so strange.
Sorry, I'm just thinking, and then the Spinosaurus turns up again because, you know, he's the big dinosaur that everyone needs to be scared of, and the Spinosaurus manages to charge through this solid metal containment fence, but then when they take refuge in a rather run-down facility, the dinosaur can't get through a wooden door.
Oh, I even noticed that too. I thought that was strange. Oh, yeah. And there's just a few things there where they just obviously haven't thought that through. They were probably the bits that they started filming before they'd written the script.
Pretty much, they think, "Ooh, hang on, what are we going to do here? I know he can bust through the fence. Where do they need to hide? They can hide in this house. Oh no, no, the dinosaur can't get in there. Okay, well, I guess the he won't be able to get through the door. What?
Yeah." Yeah, I think it sounds like they had too many people working on that film that were throwing too many ideas that just weren't sticking. So, oh gosh. But yeah, no, there are definitely a few things that stood out to me like that. So,
yeah, and I think that probably can also call the mist its own character, because there's a few times, like whenever, like again, on this tropical island where everything is always absolutely clear and it apparently never rains. You know, whenever their vision needs to be obscured, like when they work their way through what appears to be a cave system and end up inside of what is essentially a giant pterodactyl aviary, it's all misty, and they've got to cross this bridge where they can't see the other side. It's all creaky and ratchety and rickety, and they've got to cross over one at a time to build up tension. But when they all panic and all just flee across it as quickly as possible, it holds up pretty well.
Yeah, it's like, oh yeah, no, I thought, that good old mist, it seems to be like insert mist here whenever we need to be able to give it some sort of, I don't know, different sort of feel. But I think, they managed to use it as much as they could anyway, so they must have had a good budget for that.
Yeah, they had a good mist budget and I guess a fan budget, because, you know, as you mentioned before, he gets taken by a pterodactyl and dropped in the nest, and then good old base-jumping Billy takes a dive off the cliff with the parachute that they handily recovered earlier, and there's no mist. You know, he has got perfect vision in order to take evasive maneuvers from being chased and make his way to the nest to recover the kid, so... Yeah.
It must have been his lucky backpack that did it.
Absolutely, the lucky backpack, that's right. Well, it'd be nice if the lucky backpack had cleared the mist before they were attacked by the pterodactyl on the bridge.
Hey, that could have been a spin-off movie of its own, so you never know.
Yeah, I'm more thinking about subtitling Billy Dora the Explorer because of his magic backpack.
Yeah, it's the thing. It might not just be the strap that's lucky, I think it's the whole thing, so...
Yeah.
But I'd be interested to see. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that adore the film. I'm not sure. I don't know what. I'd be interested to see what diehard Jurassic Park fans think of it, because I believe Michael Crichton wrote a sequel when they were doing The Lost, for them to make the second movie. But I believe I don't think he would have written a book for this third movie. Otherwise, I think the plot would have developed a lot more. So I think this is definitely a standalone in all respects.
Yeah. He was. Oh, he's been credited as a writer on the movie, but then in brackets, characters. So, pretty much, they've taken his characters and written their own Jurassic Park story, and I guess that's probably one of the things where this doesn't quite fit in, because, I mean, the previous Jurassic Park movies, and even the most recent Jurassic World, there is quite a bit of attention on the pseudoscience, I guess, with regards to creating these creatures and how they exist, whereas this, that science portion is only used to set up the convenient plot points for later.
Yeah, and like there's a few, like I noticed, you know, as you said earlier, like the first sort of 20 minutes was them just sort of getting out as much information as they could to set everything up, and that was kind of them giving their scientific sort of stuff, but I'm glad, they didn't touch on it too much. They relied more on the action, which, you know, for someone like me who doesn't really want to sit down with all this sort of jargon sort of stuff is much better. But, there definitely was a lot more thought in the first two movies, I think, in that respect.
Yeah, so, it really does, I suppose, turn this more into a let's survive Monster Island movie than something which I think fits in with the other Jurassic Park movies. But I might be getting ahead of myself. But yeah, actually, if I can come back to him, like I mentioned, I'm a bit of a fan of William H. Macy, and so I was kind of glad to see at the end when they were having that scene on the river in the boat where the Spinosaurus comes back and basically almost drowns them all. It's William H. Macy that saves the day by climbing a crane and basically setting the river on fire. I still don't know how he set the river on fire.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. But hey, it looks good on the big screen, doesn't it? Yeah,
absolutely. But you know, go William H. Macy. You know, I respect that guy.
Yeah, he really did get in there, and like it was one of those moments where you're like, oh, is he going to survive? But hey, you know, this is a Hollywood movie, so it had to be all happy families at the end. So, but yeah, no, I thought that scene was quite good, and yeah, it was a natural sort of progression from the other sort of scenes that had happened the whole way through. So, and it was good to see him there throwing himself into it. So.
Yeah, absolutely, and I thought around the same time, because of, I mean, he also had the most resilient telephone in the world, the fact that it actually survived being eaten and excreted by a dinosaur. But when they use it to try to call back, I really should look up his name.
I know who you mean. When they're trying to ring Laura Dern, that's
yeah,
right, I think.
They call it Laura Dern, and they only get and her son picks up and gets distracted by Barney the dinosaur.
I love the juxtaposition of this cute, cuddly Barney the dinosaur whilst they're getting attacked by the real-life thing, you know. I thought that was really interesting and clever.
Yeah, and then Laura Dern only gets the briefest of snatches of conversation, and hears this sound in the background. And as far as I'm aware, she had no idea where, like, she had already met with Sam Neill before the whole thing about going to the island was set up. So from that very brief little snippet, she was able to work out exactly where they were in the entire world and call in, like, the Navy and the Marines.
Yeah, I think she pretty much said to I think he pretty much only got out pond or something like, or in the lake or something like that, and just think, yeah, she's going to know exactly. But then the funny thing is they had already pretty much got out of the lake by the time everyone had arrived to rescue them. So I found it funny that, you know, that was again another thing where they're like, oh, we better incorporate her character in a little bit more. You know, she was in the first movie. You know, so I think they're like, oh, we'll use her as that. But yeah, no, I loved the bit with the dinosaur, you know, and the Barney the dinosaur bit. I thought that was quite clever and quite frustrating, because I know what it's like when you give a phone to a kid and then you're trying to get the message across.
Yeah, absolutely. And, again, I suppose another plot point where they when they escaped the pterodactyl aviary and the camera lingered on the door not quite being closed properly. so at the end, as they're getting away from there with the aid of the handy Navy guys who had just turned up on the beach, as they got to the beach, again, nice and convenient, they landed in the exact spot that these guys were going to come out. And they see those pterodactyls flying off into the sequel that never was.
Yeah, that's one thing that stood out to me. I'm like, oh, cool, are we going to see sort of what happens now? They, you know, they're now free. They're now flying to America. What's going to happen now? And yet nothing's ever touched on it again. And it's like they wanted to use a few of those elements in Jurassic World, because there was a lot of stuff involving the pterodactyls attacking people and things like that. So I wonder if that was trying to develop that idea further that was in the third movie. So yeah, it was a strange way, but it was also, well, was this originally going to get a sequel? Was it assumed that there wasn't going to be a big gap between 3 and Jurassic World?
I would have assumed, because I mean, obviously, the Jurassic Park movies were still being successful, so I would have thought that, you know, they would have made this movie with the intention of bringing it back again. But then, you know, this movie, even though it did quite well in the box office, I guess the actual critical reaction to it kind of put everybody off dinosaur movies for a while.
And it's like it almost needed to wait that little bit longer so that more technology could be out to make them even better. So I think, you know, it may have, even though it may have killed the franchise for a little bit, it probably was the best thing to happen to the franchise. So,
and it does end, it really ends really abruptly too. So aside from the dinosaur, the pterodactyls flying off into the clouds, there really didn't seem to be a lot more that could have been gotten from that story, aside from, you know, other people turning up on the island for some other reason, or obviously these pterodactyls setting themselves up somewhere rather inconvenient for humans and see
the consequences there. Yeah, but then I suppose that as a concept probably could be something that they couldn't have really done much with. So maybe, maybe it was supposed to be open-ended like that. So we may never know.
Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you one thing that really, really would have made this movie, and I think would have, I suppose, made me respect it a great deal, because, you know, as we know, we need to watch those final credits. And as you're scrolling through, they come up with the compulsory, animal disclaimer. If they had put in no dinosaurs were harmed during the making of this motion picture, I think I would have just stood up and applauded.
Oh, that would have made it all the more worthwhile. Oh, gosh, why didn't they?
Something
it needed.
Yeah, absolutely. So was there any other points that you wanted to make at this stage, Christian? Or?
No, probably a lot of the stuff I'd already spoken about, but yeah, more sort of redeeming features, but we'll wait until we get to that section. I'm kind of dying to hear some 5-star, or I don't know if you can get that many, reviews of the film, and to hear what sort of people praising the film have to think of it.
Well, you jump in there, Christian. Remember that kind of comes in after our judgment.
Okay, well, do you want me to do the redeeming features first, then? Or?
Absolutely. I mean, I chose this movie, so I shall let you step up with your redeeming features, if you have any.
Okay, yeah, well, a couple. Look, I think the biggest thing that stood out to me in this film is the fact that it very much is, you know, and I know we've spoken about this, I'm a big fan of sequels, and I was still quite sorry for them and things like that, but I felt that this felt very unnecessary, and I think its inclusion... the reason it was released was almost unnecessary. It felt too much like they were going through the motions with the franchise, and really just trying to keep the franchise going without having to put too much extra sort of work in it. I think the fact that it's missing Steven Spielberg was a big thing, and not having it based on a Michael Crichton book would have been quite a lot too. So you've got this very slim plot that's padded out by action, and it relied too much on that and too much on the sort of what we knew of the first two films. So it felt, extremely unnecessary. It's like watching Nightmare on Elm Street 6 or something like that. That's more what it felt like to me. So, one great thing, though, about it, though, the cinematography is very good, and it's one thing I love about the fact that this is set on this island, because you're able to, have all this great location shooting in the case of this being Hawaii. So that, it does look quite good in that respect. And, I'm not a dinosaur lover, but I know there's people out there that are huge, huge dinosaur fans. So, and really the films that are made in recent times and depict these really high quality or really, very realistic dinosaurs, they're few and far between. So I really think, if you're a dinosaur buff, I still think you'll find something to enjoy out of this, because, hey, they do look great, and it's technology that we're really, we should be proud of, even if it is, 15 years old. So I definitely think it's worth seeing for dinosaur lovers, and hey, if you're a fan of the series and are interested to see it, I definitely recommend seeing it at least once. But unnecessary, it's not irredeemable, but I don't know. I wouldn't rush to watch it again, but I don't think it's even, its existence is unwarranted. That's my big thing. That's probably my final statement about it there.
Okay. Are you coming in on the line again, Christian?
No, I'm not.
Alrighty. Okay, so you're saying it's not irredeemable, so it's marginally redeemable? Is that what I'm getting?
Yeah, marginally redeemable, and a very small margin, by the way, too.
Alrighty. Well, I mean, watching this movie, I mean, there was like that's like the whole sequence at the start that was setting everything up. And I mean, we've watched so many movies where like something has been set up and or something's come in and nothing has come from it. So I'm going to give this movie some props for actually setting up situations and following through with them. Pretty much everything they set up was actually had a payoff later on in the movie, which is very rare to see. Even in a lot of sequels to quality movies, I found that once it got to the action was pretty good, and the pacing, really helped pull you through the movie, even if it was hugely predictable. I mean, you could pretty much see everything that happened coming from a mile away, but there was enough peril in there, and it kept enough pace to actually I suppose, keep people engaged and keep you a bit of excited. It actually, in that way, reminded me of that little good section of the Godzilla remake that we watched, where they were running around with the baby Godzillas. I kind of got a similar feeling.
I did actually think that while I was watching it.
Yeah. Look, I'm always happy to see William H. Macy show up, and even Sam Neill. I felt that everyone in this did put in solid performances. I know the review we read at the start pretty much said that the acting was terrible, but I didn't mind it. It wasn't great. It was pretty workmanlike. You know, it was solid. It wasn't great. It was solid. Even though Tia Leone didn't really add all that much beyond the scream factor, but I guess if you're going to have a monster movie, you've got to have the lead lady letting off a few screams. That seems to be traditional.
She seems to be the, around that period, the go-to girl for like action films. So it seemed quite appropriate to have her in there.
Yeah, yeah. I really don't think it needed to be a Jurassic Park movie after all of that. I think a lot of the Jurassic Park stuff was kind of shoehorned in there. I mean, the whole Raptor voice box thing, that was very, very clunky, I guess, in the grand scheme of things. But as a generic, we've got to survive this island full of monsters. I mean, those sort of movies do come up every now and then, and be an island, a house or whatever, you know, there's just trying to survive against very, very large odds. You know, it actually, I thought it did work in that way. And I've got to admit that I actually did quite enjoy this movie. I turned off the brain. I kind of really put the whole Jurassic Park thing to the side and sat back and enjoyed the spectacle. And from that point, I'm actually going to say I found this movie quite redeemable. And you know what? I would watch it again.
Oh, gosh. So, well, it sounds like we are both on the good side of redeemable with our responses for this film. So I'm really excited to see that we both sort of, in some way, share a common feeling about the movie. But I think what you said hits the nail on the head. Once you take it away from being a Jurassic Park film, you can just sort of watch it as pure escapism. And it's a, yeah, monster on an island, how the hell do we get off? So I think if you can look at it in that respect, it'll get you through and be a lot more of an enjoyable film. That way it doesn't put the pressure on you to sort of feel like it has to stand up to be like a Jurassic Park film of that quality.
Absolutely. I'm still thinking I'm going to need to revisit Jurassic Park 2 at some point, but I'm not going to rush to that, and I'm certainly not going to suggest it as a redeeming feature anytime in the near future, so you can relax on that.
That's all right. Even though it did, you know, watching this did make me, I felt like I should have probably watched 2 before 3, but from the sounds of it, they are very standalone, so I don't think, you know, one day it'll happen.
Absolutely. So you've come in as just redeemable, I've come in as quite redeemable, and you know what? I think we've got people out there who thought even more about this movie and had better feeling towards this movie than even me sitting here telling people that I would watch it again. And I've got another review here that you seem quite keen to hear a little earlier on.
Dying to know what the angle they took was.
So the title of this review is Great Effects. I was so excited when I heard that Sam Neill would be returning. Don't get me wrong, Jeff Goldblum was great in The Lost World, but I think it would have been a whole lot better if Sam Neill had been with him. The effects were breathtaking, and the dinos were scarier than ever. I admit that it's nowhere near as good as the original, but nothing can match that movie. The plot was clever and interesting and kept you guessing. Tia Leone impressed me. I never knew she was so talented. Her character was pretty stupid and deserved to be killed. Oh my goodness. But I was okay with her sticking around. Alessandro Nivola was superb. He's so cool. He can play an upper-class aristocrat in Mansfield Park and then come down and play around with the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park 3. Very impressive. It was great to finally have some flying dinosaurs. I was a little disappointed that there weren't any in the previous two, but there were enough here to satisfy me. They were very realistic. The neatest part was when they were in the gigantic birdcage with the flying dinosaurs. It was really imaginative and exciting. 5 stars. They've got a fan of the pterodactyls who would have liked to have seen that sequel with the pterodactyls flying off into the sunset.
Yeah, I think they were probably in the... the ones I'm championing for that. So interesting they gave the 5 stars, but they seemed like they were quite a fan of the actors in general and just happy that those particular actors were in it. So I don't know. But, it's good to see that the camp is divided because that's what makes entertainment, especially with a film. So
there we go. A Jurassic Park 3, a redeemable movie. I feel so good when I get to say that because, let's be honest, it doesn't happen very often.
It has been a while. So, you never know, Trevor, though. It could all take a turn for the worse, in no time. So we should be thankful we've got we've got one that we can redeem at the same, both of us at the moment. So, and celebrate that. So,
I'm just curious, Christian, are we likely to continue that run for the next one?
Well, that's the thing, Trevor. I have a feeling we won't be able to, actually. So now I've, throughout the year, I keep, notes of different films that I think of. And this time around, I hadn't actually had anything up my sleeve. Obviously, I've thought of it now, but, in the last sort of week or so, I hadn't had anything up my sleeve. I was, flicking through television the other day, and on Saturday night, a film came on, and I thought, ooh, this is so bad, this movie. Why have Trevor and I never done this for the podcast? So I thought it was about time that we watched. I have seen it only in bits and pieces over the years, and it's probably one that you'll shudder when I mention it. But, Trevor, I thought we should look at 1997, 1998, Batman and Robin.
Oh, my goodness. The one with the nipples on the batsuit.
Yes. I literally am racking my brains because I'm like, why have we not done this for the podcast already? I thought it was perfect fodder. And when I saw it on TV, I'm like, no, I'm turning it off straight away. I'm going to save it and we'll do it for the podcast because there's just so much about it, just the bits I've seen, that my jaw is on the floor. So I'm looking forward to seeing what you think of Batman and Robin.
Oh, my goodness. I really don't know what to say about that. I had seen it quite some time ago and never went back to it, to be honest.
I think that's the common thing I hear from people. So I've seen the first two quite a lot, and I'm a bit of a guilty pleasure of Batman Forever, but... Batman and Robin has been one that I haven't actually seen all the way through, but based on everything you hear about it, it sounds like it's a flop inside and out. So let's see if it's redeemable or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, you picked one that's rated at 3.7 on IMDb. I guess that gives us a bit of a feel of what we're in for. But you know what? I'm going to remain optimistic. And let's see if we can redeem Batman and Robin from 1997.
And even if it is just because you've got Arnold Schwarzenegger as Mr. Freeze, that could be our redeeming feature. So we'll wait and see. But I'll be looking forward to chatting about this one because I think it'll be a lot of fun.
My goodness. You've actually taken me by surprise. I actually would not have expected this one from you. So
I was quite surprised. See what happens when you don't plan too far ahead, and you'll be more spontaneous.
Wonderful.
Thank you, Free to Air TV, for putting the idea. looking forward to it. So going from Jurassic World 3 to Batman 4, I suppose, if you want to look at it like that.
Look, if anybody out there has any comments or any thoughts that they would like to give to us, either about Jurassic Park 3 or about Batman and Robin, I'm just still trying to get my head into the right space, and I think I'm just going to have to grab it, watch it, and see what happens. But you can certainly let us know and get in touch with us very, very easily. You can find the Rufus Project on Twitter, on Facebook. You can head to our homepage, therufusproject.podomatic.com, and leave your comments below this very episode, just down there, down below if you're on the website. Or you can send us an email to therufusproject@gmail.com, and we certainly would love to hear from you.
For sure. I'd love to hear what people have to think about any of the films that we attempt to redeem, but in this case we've redeemed this time around, so I'm pretty impressed.
Absolutely. And of course, if you have a suggestion or a challenge for us, we'd also love to hear that too, even though that thought kind of scares me.
Exactly, considering the things that I can come up to suggest. So imagine if we leave it open for the general public. So I'll be looking forward to it, though.
Again, I'm very happy that this Redeeming Features podcast has actually ended up with a redeeming verdict. So I think that's a great place to finish off. So, Christian, as always, thank you so much. This has been awesome.
Thanks, Trevor.
Too good to be bad, so bad it's good. What's this movie? Do you think we should? It's got bad dialogue, dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy? Oh boy.
Christian and Trevor on the case, watching movies from all over the place. IMDb says it's bad, but we want to know, is it fun to be had?
Boy? Oh boy.
Redeeming features.